We're going to get started, everybody. If you're near a door, hey, thank you very much. Okay, so my name is Dave Bustle. I am an ELTA volunteer and on the conference committee this year. And so it's my job to shepherd this session along. The session is titled...
Was titled,
Shooting for the Clouds, an In-Depth Look at Cloud Computing. There is always a few housekeeping issues. For those of you who have been here before at ELTA, most of these you'll know. Please turn your phones to silent. Odds are good I will make fun of you, especially when my phone rings really loudly. So I will turn my phone to silent. Evaluation. We live and die on these evaluations to make sure our sessions are the right topics and for the right focus group. It's all on your app. So just go to your app in there and you'll see sessions evaluations and able to find the sessions. If you have questions, reach out to me at the end. I'll be around and I'll certainly help you out if you need to be. This session is recorded. ELTA records 90% of our sessions, so if you're not available here, you can come back and listen to it at a later time. And also, so I'll remind our speakers to talk into the microphone. And if you have questions, I think we're going to do questions at the end, but if they come up in the middle, wait for me to run around and get you with a mic. Oh, yeah. So this year, ELTA has this. This is the microphone. So you can throw it at people, which I will not be doing because it did what I just thought it would do and bounced off. So I will probably be running around with a microphone giving it to you so your coffee doesn't spill all over your laptop.
Put all the coffee away now.
Yeah. I don't plan to throw those things around. I'm just going to run around. Okay. Our panelists. So Rich Lilly from Netrix and Michael Kemps for ICS, which is what I actually have known them as. And I'm going to turn it over to them. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. So we're going to be focusing on two major vendors today. I'll be talking to the perspective of the Microsoft Azure Cloud Solution. Michael will be talking about Amazon Web Services. I'm sure most of you are probably familiar with both of those vendors. We're going to start with kind of the high-level concepts of cloud computing. So there's a lot of options, a lot of platforms out there. So really, you know, it's not just these two, right? I'm sure you guys are all aware there's Google Cloud, there's Cisco Cloud, there's private clouds all over the place. So there's so many options. How do you go out there and evaluate what's really going to be good for your firm specifically? Really, it's going to be the difference is going to be ease of use specifically. So, you know, not every cloud is going to be right for everyone. So definitely evaluate a lot of your options. We're going to be walking through a lot of those options and things you can do with the different clouds. There's a broad spectrum of different services that you can offer outside of each cloud for each cloud vendor. And then really, it's about making the right decision for your firm. So again, looking and evaluating all the options, the biggest part is really aligning your firm's requirements. So again, it's not going to be a catch-all. So definitely look at what you're looking to do and align that with the vendor and along with what's a solution they're offering within their cloud as well.
So one thing we like to do in this community is compare and contrast our selections of vendors and who we've chosen, and that purchasing survey is amazing for that. One thing that we did when we looked at cloud providers was to start looking at Gartner's graphs and to analyze who was in that famous top right quadrant. And the interesting thing about this session is it was chosen specifically to hit those top two vendors. It wasn't so clear maybe 3 years ago. AWS was there, Microsoft had done a lot of climbing, and the slide was much smaller, it was a lot more fractional, and these two vendors have done a phenomenal job of both continuing to support and improve their solutions and push it along. Separate topic from the session, but if you look sort of at the bottom of the slide in comparison between the two, you'll see Google, VMware, you know, IBM, SoftLayer, et cetera, they're moving to the right as visionaries, but they really haven't moved up to that leader quadrant.
So some of the considerations that I was talking about, so things like looking at the number of users and what kind of future growth and expansion. It's about where your firm is going to be, right? Not where it's at today. So evaluating that solution to make sure it can grow and scale accordingly is a very important piece of this as well. One of the biggest ones, right? You're going to the cloud, you're going to a provider that's giving you a service. Make sure it aligns with your service level agreements. Not every vendor has the same SLA, and it may not meet what your firm's SLA is going to be as well. So absolutely go through those requirements. And one thing we'll talk about too is there's many different layers, right? They may have different SLAs for storage, they may have different SLAs for compute. So make sure whatever service you're looking to deploy on that platform aligns with your firm's SLAs as well. And then also the amount of data and type of data. How are you storing this this data in the cloud? It's not just flat file storage. It's about looking at, do you want to do table storage? Do you want to do SQL as a service, MySQL as a service? There's going to be a lot of different options there that allow you to store that data in different manners that's going to be most efficient for your solution as well.
So an interesting story that relates to sort of planning and DR and the benefits of either of the two of these, frankly. This wasn't part of this presentation, but I wanted to share this story. About a week and a half ago in Los Angeles, maybe some are familiar, there was an explosion at the bottom of a building. It was actually 811 Wilshire Boulevard. And by some odd coincidence, we ended up having a client in the building that already had their firm fully up on AWS in the cloud. And again, in this case, it could have been either vendor. So building explosion happens late in an evening. Client's stuck, can't get in the building. They end up red tagging the building, and as we sit here, the building is still red tagged. Every single one of their people went home and worked, fully functional in that environment. So to the point of DR and planning and getting data offsite, these things do happen, and they happen when you least expect them. So that is to the DR initiatives. Mobility. You know, these cloud providers provide access into their systems and solutions with security sets that vary. And obviously, we all have people in demand of mobility and mobility applications and the way those things are configured. The other is how your environment's connected, what other SaaS providers you're connected to and utilizing, you know, things like Mimecast, et cetera. Telephony is a big one. In terms of quality of service and voice and the way that your solutions are configured, can I put my voice server up in that environment and still maintain quality of service, and how are those packets traveling? Security and compliance are huge. The nice thing about cloud vendors that are mainstream is they've invested and continue to invest more in security and in back-end configuration and certifications than we could ever do on our own in an individual firm. And I think there's a lot of fear around that cloud conversation. Oh no, we lose the data, we're in the cloud. And I take a much closer look, frankly, between both vendors.
And one thing I'll touch on, too, is that lifecycle world as well. So I think one thing that has started to happen over the last couple of years is the concept of shadow IT. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with it. It may be the accounting piece of the organization. It may be someone who's doing litigation support, going out and building their own service without actually going through IT. It happens all too often. So standing out and really starting either a community internally or starting a board that can actually look at how to adopt the cloud within the organization allows you to tackle this stuff before it gets out of hand, right? And that happens a lot. One of the biggest things is governance, right? So how do we keep on developing these resources? People are going to put, but they may not take away. And it's kind of this crazy growth pattern. And because it's as a service, you're going to get charged for it. So making sure that it doesn't get out of hand and wrapping your arms around that with policy first is a very important piece of this as well.
So let's start digging into these two vendors a little bit. And we didn't intend this as a shootout per se, but as an opportunity for you to compare and contrast. There's a lot of similarities. So again, I'll take the Amazon side and he'll push on the Microsoft and we'll flip-flop between and then we can compare, contrast, and talk about it at the end. So Amazon's contractual commitments. So three options, on-demand, reserved, and spot. Frankly, in our community, it's going to be on-demand and reserved. And effectively, on-demand is creating the ability to spin up an instance and select the instance type. We'll get into the details and the types of instances, et cetera, in a minute. And then be billed for those on an hourly basis. So I can spin something up, say in a test environment, create it, configure it, use it, and when I'm done with it, shut it off. That's on demand in the AWS world. Reserved is a contractual commitment, either 1 year or three, and it is specific to the region that you are placing that instance in. We'll get into that when we get into regions. So reserved instances, you commit to those when you know you're going to be in them for a year to 3 years. And there is there's a significant cost difference when you make that contractual commitment.
And on the Azure side, there's kind of a very similar concept. So very similarly, there's pay-as-you-go. So think of this like, you know, you've got your credit card lined up and you're going to pay for a service on a monthly basis. There are probably somewhere in the order of 100 different services that Microsoft offers within their Azure cloud, whether it be compute, whether it be storage, whether it be identity. Each one of those has a different value, and there's a page that you can walk through, a calculator, a couple different options there as well. So really, you need to look at what you're trying to provision and then obviously cost that out as well, and there's some great calculators and things out there. Very similarly, though, again, this is a monthly, per-month cost, so whatever you use, you're going to have to pay for. In addition, there's also going through Microsoft resellers as well. So there are organizations that can resell Azure, and you can go through them. There's a new model that allows that organization to actually support you from an Azure perspective as well. And then also, very similar, there's a yearly contract, an enterprise agreement. Everyone's probably familiar with a Microsoft enterprise agreement. This is actually what's called an Azure-only enterprise agreement. Essentially, what you do is you go through and you evaluate what your usage is going to be for the next year, and you make that commitment ahead of time. The benefit there is you get a reduced cost, and you have the option of again, continuing that year over year for your consumption as well. So these are a couple different ways, and there's also some great free trials out there for both Amazon and Azure as well. So again, if you're looking to go try some of these services, you can go out there today and get, you know, up to a couple hundred dollars worth of services to test some of the things we're talking about today.
One of the common questions about cloud computing is, where's my stuff? Where's my data? Not to mention, how do I get it out once I put it in? But specifically, you know, where does Amazon place my data? And the answer is, you have control of that. Primary data centers in the United States are U.S. West and East. West is comprised of Northern California and Oregon, and East is located in Virginia. In the console, you have the ability with a master account to configure the environment to not allow those that are provisioning services to do so outside of the United States, and vice versa, those that are not within the U.S. and don't want things covered by, say, the Patriot Act, have the ability to control and keep those things outside of the country as well.
So very similarly, Azure, so data is paired between sister data centers. So again, east, west, US, north, south. As we go into, you know, Brazil, Europe, et cetera, there's always a sister data center. And this gets kind of back to the concept of for disaster recovery, business continuity as well. Again, on the same plane, the data can't replicate out of that specific paired region unless you forcefully replicate it via some other mechanism. So again, if I'm storing data in East U.S., it's not going to just automatically replicate over to Europe. Not all services are offered in every single region. We'll get to that. I got a map coming up in a second. There's 19 different Azure regions today, with more coming on board as well. Today, I would say that there's a little bit of gap in some of the European countries for some of the services that are offered. But over the course of probably the last month or two, they brought those services or lit up those services in the different regions as well. Microsoft also allows customers to access preview features. So when we talk about general availability of something new, literally this platform changes on a weekly basis. There is the ability for you to test kind of new preview functions, and they'll actually support those as well to some extent. There's also additional locations coming on board, so for anyone that does any business in Canada or India, there are two pairs of data centers coming on in each of those regions as well. And finally, Microsoft does hold data center tours, so if you do have a data center that's local to you, reach out to your Microsoft rep. I suggest getting a tour. It's a fantastic experience, whether it's Amazon or Azure. You don't really understand the scale until you see containers of, you know, storage and compute sitting in front of you. And I know it's a little bit of an eye chart in front of you, but those are some of the Azure data centers as well. Again, 19 today with another 4 coming on board.
So what do I select? And how do I choose it? And how large is it, and what do I have to pay for it? That's sort of what's next. And whereas today we're familiar with, say, in a physical hardware or a VMware or virtual environment, being able to go and take all available RAM that we have or CPU that we have and allocate it and move things around, in these cloud environments, you end up choosing specific CPU and RAM instances or an instance with specific RAM and CPU, and then attaching that to disk, and those are dedicated specific instances to you. So you're not simply sliding up the amount of memory and sliding up the amount of CPU. You absolutely can, though, then say, you know what, I chose an instance that's too small, I'm going to stop it, change my instance selection, restart it, and off I'm running.
And this is some of the examples of some of the Azure VM sizes. So again, similar concept here in the fact that they are fixed sizes, and that's primarily to be able to cost them appropriately as well. You see some of the different sizes from a shared core model down at 768 megs of RAM, all the way up through the D series, and there's also what's commonly referred to as the Godzilla series or G series. So if you need a 32 core, 500 gigs of RAM VM in the cloud to process something, maybe for a Minecraft server for your kids, you can absolutely do that and run it. Again, everything we've talked about here too on the Azure side is a per minute bill. So if you do want to build that for 2 minutes and not get charged $22,000 a month, you can absolutely go spin that up for probably $100 or so.
That's probably what created Godzilla to begin with. Okay, so that's CPU and RAM. What do I do about disk? And I like to look at these environments by saying, think of a fully configured SAN that doesn't have any size limits, that you can carve out at your own necessity, that you're not forced to go out and spend large amounts of money to upgrade in trays and disks and performance. You have the ability to go in and select a volume and say, you know what, I need it to be X amount in size. I need dedicated IOPS to it. And then I can also get into encryption. Those volumes then attach to those CPU instances, can be attached or detached, et cetera. And there it is. If I need to grow it, I grow it. If I need to create another one, move data, and eliminate it, I can do the same. That one's actually mine. So into selection of volume types. And again, you can actually go in and select, look, I either want solid state disk, which is by default on the AWS side today, or I can go back and say, you know what, I want to save some money, I don't need that much performance, give me magnetic disk. Or on the high end, I can go in and say, you know what, yeah, SSD is great, but I need dedicated IOPS per volume, and then I can also span those volumes together to increase it further.
Same thing applies on the Azure side as well. So again, there's four different types of ways to store this data within Azure. Also, I'll point out that there is what I'll call standard storage and then premium storage, which is a much higher tier, much higher IO as well. So when we talk about storing data in any one of the Azure data centers, if you choose not to replicate it, it's actually stored three times across three separate fault domains within that data center. So separate racks, separate network, you can lose any one component and still be up and running. There's also zone redundant as well as geographically redundant, so if you're trying to replicate data across to the sister data center that we talked about, you can do that as well, and I can barely read the last one. Read access as well. So if I want to do a read-only access for maybe testing disaster recovery or testing my read times from another data center in the event of a disaster, we can do that as well. And there are different types of storage. So again, within Azure, you can see there's a whole bunch. One is the most common is going to be your block blobs. So this is where all your virtual machine storage is actually, your IaaS VM storage is stored. There's also Azure files. So if you're looking to access data via SMB 2.0 in the cloud, you can do that. And there's various use cases for that. Maybe I want a highly available FTP server with scale-out storage in the back end and not have to own the virtual machine that's a part of that. You know, a lot of what we're talking about today is infrastructure as a service, but know that there's also, you know, platform as a service and software as a service offerings out there as well. So again, you know, as we kind of get down into that layer, it's going to be more and more of a refined cost based on what I want to do. And also page blobs and disks, tables and queues. Again, a great site. If no one's ever seen haveibeenpwned.com, it's actually all built on Azure storage. So they're loading in, you know, the 54 million records from the Adobe hack or from the Ashley Madison hack or anything else. You can actually go out there and search your email address or someone's email address to see if it's in there. And that's actually all built on Azure storage. And again, I can search millions and millions and millions of records in the matter of milliseconds. And then the last thing is import-export. So if you have a large amount of data that you need to move to the cloud, one of the biggest concerns is how do I get that data up there quickly and effectively, especially when we're talking about terabytes of data. Now there's actually what's called an import-export service. So you can take that drive, export it, send it off to Microsoft, and they'll load it in their system so I don't have to pay, you know, hundreds or sometimes thousands of dollars in getting that data transacted up to the cloud.
Very, very similar on both sides. So how about encryption? Got my data in the cloud, what am I going to do with it? AWS has a key management service, which is a separately managed, fully redundant, across all regions managed service that supports encryption keys across almost all of the AWS services. So I can then create an encrypted volume in which the key management service manages it, again, independent and separate of, with HSM integration.
And maybe you want to talk about why it's important to own your key, right? That's a big security question we get a lot, right?
Absolutely important to own your key. And not only own your key, but have keys rotate so that, you know, you have control and that you maintain, you know, legal separation and control as well.
Absolutely.
Client-side encryption is just simply supported with client-side tools, fully supported. And again, you know, with multiple different types of storage. Here's a screenshot of actually setting up and creating an encrypted volume within the AWS infrastructure. This happens to be an EBS volume that I mentioned earlier. Same exists with their simple storage service, or S3.
And same thing in Azure as well. So again, Microsoft Azure Storage client-side encryption actually just went generally available earlier this month. There's also, again, from the client side, there's plugins. A company called CloudLink actually offers the ability to encrypt the client-side volumes. And then, two, again, we talked about the importance of owning your own key. Today, a lot of the big concerns are, what if Microsoft has my key? What if Amazon has my key? And then the NSA comes knocking, right? That's a big concern for everyone in this room. In this case, you have the ability to generate your own key within the HSM and manage that effectively. So, again, you own that data. And I won't say it's not possible, but much harder for them to be able to take that data from a vendor. And again, you have the backing of companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft that are actually fighting the federal government in a lot of these cases as well.
How much harder? Okay. Backup and DR. This is a great subject, and a lot of people ask me, okay, look, you know, it's nice that we can go take our whole environment if we're a small firm and go slam it into the cloud. That's not possible for a larger environment. Can I do it by app? Can I do it, you know, by section? And the answer, of course, is absolutely. One of those areas is backup and DR. So let's say that I'm not ready to move my firm to the cloud, but I want to back up my existing environment and use it as a replication spot. Perfect. Let's say that I want to take it a step beyond that and take those backups and create server instances in the cloud, use that as a replication location, so as in a DR scenario, I can maybe spin those instances up and constantly update those snapshots to the point of hot standby where, you know, it is available to be failed over. In the last environment with multi-site, I take my info, I put it in the cloud, I'm actually running live, and then I take it from my primary region or availability zone, snapshot it to another location, say, from Northern California to US East in Virginia, and then when I lose the service, I have the ability to spin it up. That's also an answer to, not that I would expect to see this, but you know, some would say, well, it's nice that you have it in that region or that availability zone on the West Coast. You know, you have the massive earthquake, and let's just say that their data center's impacted. What happens to my data? Well, you've got it snapshotted, highly available, and can be started up instantly on the East Coast. This is a screenshot of actually a third-party tool called Cloud Protection Manager that we use, and it goes into the Amazon environment and will take those snapshots and send them to the other region. So this is actually a snapshot of that occurring in a job and with live data replicated in the background.
And you know, before I dive into the slide, one important thing I'll point out as well is again, it's all about getting back to the business case, right? So you know, we talk about the different offerings, like whether it be hot availability, whether it be passive standby. Make sure you understand what your business requirements are, because that's going to help drive a lot of the decisions that are made between the different tiers for, say, disaster recovery. You know, examples like you're always going to want an Active Directory domain controller up, right? So things like SQL, does that actually support a lot of other applications, and what's the RTO, RPO for that as well? Make sure you understand those, and make sure you define those, because if you just kind of take a stab at it, you may find in the event of a disaster that you actually don't have a service that's meeting your business needs as well. I'll point out within Azure, there's backup and disaster recovery options both. launched actually a couple months ago was infrastructure as a service backup. So a lot of the questions I get asked are, all right, great, if I move my part of my environment up to Azure, or if I move it, you know, from a disaster recovery perspective up to Azure, how do I back that up once it gets up there? So Microsoft launched infrastructure as a service backup. So again, your common policies, your backup timings. There's also some advanced retention policies up there as well. So when you do deploy these services to the cloud, you actually don't have to, if you don't want to, deploy a semantic backup exec, a net backup, et cetera. This is all baked into the service itself. So again, a huge advantage there where it's something that you don't have to worry about supporting another backup solution as it goes offsite. In addition, I don't think I have a slide on this, but I'll point out that if you are trying to offsite your data as well, storage in Azure in AWS is extremely cheap, and you know, we're talking pennies on the dollar for gigabytes. So one of the biggest questions I get asked is, you know, how do I store that data? And a lot of vendors, I think there's for Azure at least about 5 to 6 different vendors that support leveraging blob storage in Azure very, very cheaply to get that data offsite, which then can be replicated in other regions as well.
Very similar.
And this is actually just an example. Again, this is actually before the change in policies, but very simple. You choose the VM, you choose your backup retention time, and really that's about it. So again, you can go there, you can restore that data. In the event of a disaster, you can restore that or restore individual files as well. And this is going to be a big slide, but I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. You can just build out the slide if you want. There's various different disaster recovery options. So. Microsoft in years past has been very, very focused on Microsoft for good reason. As you guys have probably seen in the last couple of years, that's opened up quite a bit. Today, for disaster recovery options for Hyper-V, for instance, if you're on their hypervisor platform, I can replicate directly to the cloud. So I can, you know, replicate that down to as low as every 30 seconds, fail that VM over with a recovery plan, and it comes up nearly immediately. This can either be done from like a small branch office scenario for a single Hyper-V server to the cloud, or if you have your data center built on a Hyper-V cluster, that can be moved over as well. A couple other things I'll point out. I know there's probably a lot of VMware customers in here. Can I see by a show of hands who's a VMware shop? A really good amount in here. Any Hyper-V customers? Hopefully a couple. So Microsoft did acquire a company, I believe about a year or so ago, that gave them the ability to replicate, from a disaster recovery perspective, VMware directly to Azure. So this has actually been a huge step, and for you, those of you that are thinking, hey, you know, it's Microsoft, so it's not going to support, you know, a disaster recovery, that's open wide up now. And again, we've got a lot of customers that I'm seeing saying, okay, hey, we can leverage this for physical servers, VMware servers, Hyper-V servers. So again, broadening that range for disaster recovery options to the cloud as well.
So into monitoring and metrics. Every service in the AWS environment can be monitored. Everything from failures to restarts to CPU and memory utilization, disk, everything that's on this slide and more. And direct notification via multiple methods when it hits thresholds. Just a sample, we'll take this data and we have our own internal tools and receive notifications and have it automatically create tickets for us. So fantastic without third-party intervention or integration delivery of data. It's awesome.
And the same thing on the Azure side. So again, if we're measuring a service metric, if we're measuring a VM metric, everything is reported up through the management console. So again, this data can then be either shown within the console via email or can be connected to on-premises monitoring platforms as well. So there's various options that can help pull those performance counters into your native monitoring system. So I think that's actually the last slide. I know we're only at about 30 minutes. Our hope is we could take some questions from the audience for those of you that are still awake. I would love to hear.
It was kind of a technical session.
It was so. Very, very technical. I would love to hear any questions, any barriers, roadblocks, questions that you guys may have in trying to adopt the cloud within your firms, and maybe potentially, you know, what you're looking to do even. And we'd love to hear those questions and answer them. Yeah. What's that?
Hello. What do you think of vCloud Air versus Azure?
Versus Azure. So vCloud Air, so it's very integrated, obviously, into the VMware platform. For the concept of what we're talking about today, you know, infrastructure as a service, VMware Air does really, really well, right? So they're baked directly into the VMware platform. That replication exists there. They only really do one thing, though, right? And that's, you know, disaster recovery and replication from a VMware environment. If you look at what Amazon and Azure can do, their platform isn't just IaaS, right? There's about 100 other things that each one of those services it can do. So for my experience interaction, it does a good job at what it's meant to do. If you're looking to do a broader cloud strategy, I would say maybe evaluate some of the other options out there.
I was actually frustrated at the time that we were looking at AWS to begin with, not to slam one or the other, but we were such a VMware shop to the same point. And when VMware started talking cloud, we got all excited. And frankly, had been severely disappointed. And as a result, you know, made a much deeper dive into AWS, frankly, because it was, you know, 2.5-3 years ago that we did it. Microsoft has made a lot of strides. And I would actually say these two services, obviously there's differences, but they've become much more equal in the last 12 to 18 months.
Rich. Yeah.
Nah, speak. You're good.
Yeah, so on the Azure side, there are Azure Management Packs that integrate directly there. Configuration Manager, there's no direct integration, but you can do cloud distribution points that are actually housed in Azure. So again, same concept if you had 5 other data centers, just consider Azure another data center. So those Azure DPs are supported there, and then SCOM can both be monitored from kind of the service level down to like the agent level for, say, a Windows VM as well. So it doesn't change anything to how you'd be monitoring on-premises today, and you can monitor both sides of that, both the platform and the VMs.
How do you, I didn't intentionally was going to throw this at you, but let's see if we can address it for the benefit of the group. How do you handle desktop as a service and with Azure?
Yeah, so Microsoft's focus on desktop as a service isn't more the traditional VDI platform like maybe Amazon does. So there is a service called Azure Remote App that actually offers the ability to do session virtualization directly from the cloud. So if anyone's worked with remote desktop services in the past, same concept, but consider a hosted service. You take your session host image, it may have all your legal applications on it, upload it, and that's going to scale to meet that demand, and you can publish your Outlook, your Word, your litigation software, et cetera. So their approach is a little bit different, where I know you guys, I believe, on the AWS side, are a little bit more focused on actually building a true virtual desktop.
Yeah, so there's really two options on the AWS side. Either you spin up a server and do a similar, you know, historical RDS or Citrix configuration inside of your platform with your other EC2 instances, or Amazon released a service called Workspaces that actually uses PCO IP, same as VMware's VDI. And you can set up dedicated hardware that is specific to each instance, upload an image, deploy that image, and make it available to all of your end users as a specific VDI-based client, but then connected to the Amazon region that it exists in. We'll hear you better.
Test. I guess it's on. Could you speak to pricing a little bit and how contractual arrangements may evolve in the future?
Yeah, we were going to try to stay away from pricing this, but
I'll do it.
Go for it.
Let me do it. I can't promise somebody else's futures, but I can give you I can give you history.
Okay, I just want to put it in perspective and think about SQL licensing as an example of something that might affect somebody's decision to go this route.
Sure. I'll start.
You can take the SQL question because that's good for Azure.
Yeah, you know, actually, so SQL is actually an interesting topic. So with SQL and Azure specifically, you can actually bill as a service. So today, if you were to go out and buy an 8-core, you know, SQL license, it's probably, what, $24,000 or something crazy like that. I think we all know roughly about that, what that's going to be. SQL is actually, you can rent that license in Azure. So what's interesting is if you only want to run a SQL service for a short amount of time to run some batch queries or things like that, you can literally go provision that, run your queries, tear it down after 8 hours. So you're essentially renting that license. Now there's kind of a fine line, right? If you don't necessarily want to rent that license for 4 years, because now you're going to probably pay more than the cost of that actual license would be. So evaluate how you're deploying SQL specifically in something like Azure, because it may affect the overall cost there as well. But again, generally on the pricing side outside of SQL, you know, each option has a different cost, right? There's a compute cost, there's a storage cost, a network transaction cost. I'm not going to do apples to apples. I don't know what the one-to-one, you know, cost would be for each. But when you go through that costing, there's some great tools or calculators available for both solutions that allow you to take that into account. And then certainly from a price change perspective, I've only seen the prices going down. I think right now with cloud providers, it's kind of the race to zero.
On the Amazon side, on the EC2 instances, there's been 42 price drops.
Yep. And every time that Amazon drops, Azure drops as well.
By the way, on the to the SQL point, just to compare and contrast, since we're doing it on the AWS side, there's a service called RDS, Relational Database Service, that same thing. Spin it up, provide SQL, provide access to it. When you're done with it, spin it back down.
Yeah, and I'll point out too. I think I don't recall about AWS, but with Azure, you know, I just talked in the context of IaaS. There's also SQL PaaS as well. So if you need just database level access, very limited, don't want to own the overall infrastructure, the VM that's related to that, you can deploy SQL in a PaaS option as well.
Yeah, same.
Answer your question,
gentlemen. They've given me the mic. We're supporting Relativity in AWS Cloud now, and we'll be supporting Azure this fall. But we still get a lot of pushback from attorneys on security issues. Mm-hmm. And we explain that it's different than having two servers locked in a closet in terms of security.
It's way better than having your servers locked in a closet.
You'd be surprised. But how do you overcome this? Is this a generational thing, or what do you advise in this?
Well, I would make a couple of points, and maybe you can join in too. AWS has a specific security page. It's actually aws.amazon.com/security, and on that page they go into very in-depth details, probably more than these people would want to read, about their security, the background, the number of certifications, the certifications bodies that have secured them, and validated them, etc. So, you know, I think the reality is in a day and age when we hear nothing but, you know, NSA and hacking and you know, people piercing into law firms, et cetera, developing things in an environment that, you know, is specifically a data center that is a shared environment, specifically designed for this and managed by experts 24/7 doing this, how do we accomplish that either as an outside vendor or as an inside IT department in the law firm? It's impossible. So that would be the road I would go down. I can't really address the generational issue per se, but the security argument is strong.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. So Microsoft has the Trust Center, which is, you know, 200 or 300 pages of information about how things are deployed, managed, the red team, blue team concept they use to detect hacks and potentially forcefully hack the environment as well. So it's a lot of understanding. Again, they're lawyers, so they probably love reading that 300 pages. but everything is out there and publicly available. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions, too, about the cloud specifically, in that if I put a service out there, it's freely available to everyone. It's all about how you lock it down. There's options for site-to-site connectivity. There's options like Direct Connect and Express Route that allow you to extend your MPLS into Azure as well. So that truly becomes a private connection, right? So that exposure becomes much less. So I think it's about just, you know, understanding and education more than anything else. And the information's out there. It's about how you, you know, get it to those people in the right terms. But you're certainly not the only one that's tackling this.
Hey, guys, I have a use case I'd like to hear you guys talk about, the automation of provisioning. So, you know, the use case that comes to mind for me is like in discovery services and processing of data, that you could scale up and scale down resources based on load. Could you guys discuss some other use cases and maybe how that works?
Sure. I'll go outside of legal and use a great example. One of AWS's largest customers is Netflix. And by the way, I'm gonna wind the security question back in. People look at me and say, "Well, we're a law firm. How could our data possibly be secure in the cloud? Do you use Netflix? Well, yeah. Do you use Spotify? Well, yeah." And I keep going down the list of apps. Guess what? They're all hosted on AWS. They're all securely controlled, etc. Stephen, relative to auto spin up, there are ways in both environments, I believe, to configure applications, specifically those that use websites and web services, to automatically spin up based on cloud metrics. So, for example, my CPUs hit X utilization. Oh, we're getting hit hard. Spin up another instance. So I'll reserve, say, 60% of my capacity is guaranteed reserved instances that I pay for over a 3-year period, and I get a 40 or 50% discount. Beyond that, you know, I don't want to have all those services running at 1 o'clock in the morning when I'm not getting hit hard, except for, you know, when I get hit at 6 a.m. So both services have the ability to auto provision and auto spin up services based on metrics.
Yeah, and the same thing in the Azure cloud as well. So infrastructure as a service can use the same based on a default image platform, obviously a stateless application, that's just as easy. But there's the options, both CPU, memory, and there's also options too. So you asked about automation, and just even outside that scale out, right? There's options in both platforms for automation with PowerShell. There's now what's called Azure Resource Manager that gives you kind of this really nice, great, you know, wizard that you can build out for an environment, right? Someone that's non-technical can actually go out and build this based on, you know, the four steps that you choose and you build on the back end as well. So both platforms have kind of some options around that automation of scale out as well as for provisioning of maybe specific services.
Some vendors, I'll use Citrix as an example, have actually created templates for doing this. Yep. On the AWS side, they'll call it CloudFormation templates, where you'll take a bunch of services that have already been created, create an environment, and then as it needs to provision and scale and grow, it has those available, and then you say, look, I'm going to select this CPU type, this amount of disk, et cetera. Take the AMI in the Amazon case, Amazon Machine Image, and spin up and start those services automatically as I need them, and then scale them back to my original provisioned result.
Hi. How much uptake do you really see in the cloud for this industry, and for which specific types of jobs, if there are specific types of things that companies prefer to do in the cloud right now?
Can you repeat the first part again?
How much uptake of cloud do you see in general in the legal industry right now?
Are you asking about adoption?
Yes, adoption. Hmm. Are companies beginning to gravitate towards this? And because there are concerns around security and some of the other things that we keep hearing all the time.
I mean, I've seen it, especially over the last couple of years, being discussed more and more. I think people aren't jumping fully in and saying, okay, we're going to move our data center to Azure, AWS right away, but kind of dipping their toes in the water with different services such as backup as a service, disaster recovery as a service, and other, you know, common core services, using that as kind of a jump-off point to say, okay, well, we really can put something in the cloud, and this really can work for us as well.
I'll give you an example that I'm actually using in another session, so I won't give you the whole example. But that is, we had a firm come to us and say, look, we're moving. And they have about 30 lawyers. And they said, look, we're sick and tired of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars every X number of years to revamp and update our infrastructure, number one. Number two, we're gonna lease a smaller space. So we want to be efficient with power, cooling, et cetera, et cetera. And we want to be able to get to everything. We want to be able to get to everything with iPads and with you know, whatever the device is at any time. And, you know, this whole thing of power testing and building down and internet unavailable and everything else, right? So we actually developed a solution with the firm, put the whole entire firm minus a couple of applications, again, dig deep into compatibility issues. We put the whole firm in the cloud. And they moved, and when they moved, they seamlessly were working while the firm was being moved, and after relocating, spun up all their existing workstations and logged in, and frankly, all we had to do was set up a new domain controller, set up a new print server, and reconnect to the new copiers, and they were rolling. So it is doable. It is being done. I do think there's a lot of reticence. I think security is a hurdle, more from a perception than a reality perspective. But you know, when you think about it, you know, lawyers say, you know, oh no, we're not going to go to the cloud. Sorry to mention vendor names. Are you on Mimecast? You're in the cloud, right?
Do you have iCloud backup configured on your
iPhone?
Right,
you have iCloud on your iPhone? Yeah, right? So I think there's, like any new technology, there's a lot of mystery and confusion, and the fact that the data is not physically located within the firm scares them or can scare them.
Is there anybody... Hello?
We got you.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody in here currently using either of these services in part or in whole?
Let me re-ask the question slightly differently. Is there anyone in the room that has AWS or Azure configured with live production data? What are you using it for? Custom external websites accessed by large numbers of people is the answer. Okay, cool.
How about as far as the consideration with everything's in the cloud, the bandwidth going in and out of your primary location. Do you really?
That's
have
the other app? Session. It's tomorrow at 3. I'm just kidding.
All right.
Yeah, so it's very much like considering a single site law firm that starts creating remote offices, right? What do you do? Well, you go to Riverbed or Silver Peak and you get WAN acceleration. So using Amazon as example, I don't know the Microsoft answer to this, but Amazon will support spinning up an instance that's running a virtual instance of a Riverbed appliance, so that if you decide, no, I'm not going to use Citrix or Desktop as a Service or RDP to get in, and I want to make it feel like my stuff is, you know, available and performs well, regardless of the fact that I have big internet connections on both sides, to get down from that latency, yes, WAN acceleration is a good way to go.
And the same thing on the Azure side as well. So from that perspective, there's also, you know, site-to-site VPN tunnels, which again would be no different than connecting a branch office to a primary location. But there's also options like Direct Connect and Express Route, where you can dedicate a high bandwidth, low latent connection that can either extend into your MPLS or extend into various vendors' data centers as well. So if you truly need that 1 gig connection into Azure, you can get that as well. And same thing with Direct Connect as well.
Yeah, but the reality is light only travels so fast. We can't make that faster somehow. I don't know, but right.
See a question over here in the middle.
You had mentioned that AWS was capable of automatically creating tickets based on certain parameters. I was just curious as to whether or not you knew what ticketing systems that might work with, and whether or not.
So it's not creating. It's not integrated to and creating the tickets itself. Okay. It's shooting a notification to a ticketing system that is grabbing that snapshot email or whatever notification, and then spinning it up in its own ticketing system.
Okay. So in that way, it should work with essentially anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just parsing the data. Questions up front here? Two.
You mentioned compatibility. Dig deep into compatibility. Can you identify maybe the top three in the last 6 months or a year compatibility challenges you run up against with application vendors, and maybe some mitigation strategies you've identified for those?
So I'll give you two. In that example with the firm that was moving, on an older version of Elite, running on good old Windows Server 2003, which you can't even spin up in AWS. It's not supported anyway. And the firm says, yeah, that's a great idea, but we'll do that next year. Well, guess what? You're keeping that server on site. Another one, ShoreTel. Had some issues with ShoreTel apps. AWS uses Citrix N Server in the back end, and ShoreTel not happy entirely. Won't dig into all the details, but those are two.
Yeah,
and the solution to both of those was, you know, maintain it on site. We have a connection, a tunneled VPN connection. Amazon calls it a VPC, virtual private cloud, just because they want to make it different than anybody else, I guess. anyway, VPN tunnel between the, you know, across the firewall to the back end, and so we have end users logging in remotely into Citrix. And then they reach back across and grab those things, and the bandwidth is so high, and the latency is great. It's 16 milliseconds between the firm and the back end. Works great. And there isn't, to the prior point, there is no riverbed in that solution.
Yeah, and I'll agree. I mean, I see a lot, more server operating system compatibility than anything else. So I hope no one in here has any server 03 left in their environment, but you guys would all run across the same challenges and try to move to a new platform.
Can we budget that for next year?
Just one more year, that's it. That's all we need. I would agree, though, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, supporting that on the server 2012 R2 platform, and making sure that can run in the cloud. And then things like, you know, that need physical level access, you know, physical USB keys for some of the software and things, you simply can't overcome that in some of those situations as
well. Yeah, a lot of vendors are starting to figure that out, though. Yep. Both with, you know, I mean, just going to virtualization to begin with, they started figuring that out. So that becomes less of a challenge in these cloud environments.
I have a question. Have you compared the costs of traditional implementation versus cloud? I mean, are you having to pay extra to move to the cloud, or is it? Are there options for keeping it pretty much the same?
I mean, I think if you're starting, it depends on where you're starting from. If you're kind of, if you're starting greenfields, for instance.
There's about six ways to answer that question.
I'll start with one of them. So in a greenfields environment, you know, you're not having to provision everything from scratch, right? That's already done as a service. There's also the ongoing maintenance costs as well, which is why a lot of folks are moving to the cloud. So again, you don't have to worry about the recycle of that storage and or refresh of that storage in 3 to 5 years. Same thing with the network, same thing with the backpack, et cetera. So I think that initial cost of entry isn't as high as some people think. Certainly getting that data up there is important and evaluation is important as well, but that's more of a testing strategy than implementation strategy. So I've just kind of seen on both sides there.
So I'll give you a direct answer and then I'll give you a side shoot. The direct answer is in comparing a single site environment with a brand new refresh where you're going to go take and buy a SAN and buy the infrastructure and buy the servers and buy. Forgetting the perpetual licensing of things like iManage, right? And just looking at the Windows and or Exchange environment, and then taking that and comparing it to the cloud, the numbers were very, very similar. Where it differs is, and where the analysis gets more interesting, is how long you're going to space it out, right? So if I go get all that equipment and I'm going to run it in a 3-year span and compare it to a 3-year cloud environment, cloud environment's going to be more expensive. If I'm in a scenario where, okay, well, I split my servers and desktops, servers 5 years, desktops 3 years, and then I also factor in the fact that maybe I don't have to replace those desktops right now because I'm going to be using desktop as a service and I don't have to go rip it all out, right? So there's more things that go into that equation. I think if you factor in things like power and cooling, things like how much support is required and patching and everything else on the back end that you don't have to do anymore, and you can actually support your environment now.
And security alone.
Well, right. And all those things together, you know, I think the whole thing works out. The bigger question becomes one of CapEx versus OpEx and how the firm is used to investing in its technology and whether or not, from a financial perspective, they're comfortable. Because, let's face it, once your data is there, you're probably not going to switch too quickly, and it's a never-ending expense. But it's recurring. It's a big mindset shift.
And one thing I'll point out, too, is you always have the option in the cloud to shrink, right? Once you purchase that hardware on-premises as part of a CapEx, you bought that 10 terabytes, you're going to own it for the next 3 to 5 years. What if the firm downsizes? What if you don't have as much data? What if you outsource some of that litigation data that you didn't plan on doing? You have that option to scale up or down, so I think you definitely get a lot more flexibility from that perspective.
And to the scale up or down point, the other issue is when you go buy hardware, right? I mean, our mindset today is, oh, boy, I better get an extra server. Oh, I need another 10 terabytes, or 10 whatever, right? 2 terabytes. I've got to size it appropriately into something larger than I need today, and I absolutely guarantee whoever's asking that there's going to be a point in that curve where I hit it, where the hardware that I have is not enough before I hit the next refresh cycle. This helps manage that and allows you to expand and contract as things change. You know, for example, spin up a war room. What am I? Okay. Am I going to maintain an inventory of hardware to set up a war room offsite somewhere? Or am I going to provide access into my environment to do that in my cloud environment, and then when I'm done, spin it off? So there's all those things, and it makes the cost discussion more difficult because the industry likes to stand up and say, go cloud, it's cheaper. No, it isn't. Not really. It's a totally different way and mindset of looking at things.
Many of the examples you've talked about are really spinning up a VM and then you're still responsible for installing the application and configuring it. At what point do you think SQL as a service, SharePoint as a service, Exchange as a service will become mainstream?
It's already happening.
Office 365.
Yeah, it's already happening.
Well, for example, like the SQL as a service. Mm-hmm. I'm told you can't run SQL agent jobs, so that renders a lot of the maintenance jobs we have in the
background. Oh, the challenges
refreshing.
Of going to SaaS solutions and losing control. It's a balance, right? Yeah. It's a balance. A vendor who shall remain nameless in this session provides a hosted solution in which a client has access that where we're used to being able to get in and configure things and touch them. And now I have to make a phone call and open a ticket. What does that do to our combined level of service, right? So we have to think through those things. SQL as a database instance that I can spin up quickly and gain access to without all the background? Sure, why not? Office 365 with Exchange? Fabulous. Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to talk about Microsoft. Sorry.
How dare you.
Is one or the other more secure? I mean, obviously, if I spin up a VM and I'm encrypting it myself, that's different than the actual service.
Yeah,
your mileage may vary. Depends on what that SaaS vendor has open. I'd like to argue no, unless you're doing a poor job of maintaining and managing your own and opening up ports that you have control of, right? By default, in most of these cloud solutions, when you spit up that VM and then you have exposed, in the case of Amazon, they call it an elastic IP. In order to be able to get into that environment, I have to forcefully open up ports. It's not like I just took a firewall out of the box and it's all open and I got to shut it all down.
Talked about the ability to expand or contract based on need. How is that covered in the contractual relationships? Because most of them tend to be volume-oriented, right? So there's some assumption about threshold so they can set pricing, right? So how does that play together?
Yeah, on the Azure side, it's monetary, right? So as you commit more cost, and depending on your level of partnership with Microsoft, you may get anywhere from a 14% to a 28% discount. And that essentially becomes a debit card, right? Or a gift card to Target, right? That you can draw from. And based on those different service costs, you're going to draw from that. It's kind of up to you or up to you and your partner, obviously, to identify what that potential cost is going to be so that you can measure that accordingly. I would say probably the same on the Azure.
A little similar, a little different. So in the smaller sizes, the creation of the EC2 instances, the actual CPU instances, is where you see the significant price drops. And those price drops happen when you commit to those reserved instances for 1 or 3 years and they are 40 to 65%, for example. Doesn't happen on the disk. And then the overall account is affected by volume that has thresholds that have small percentage drops. But on the AWS side, most of that cost drop happens on those reserved instances.
So just a little bit further, if I can.
Yeah. Not on the AWS side. On the AWS side, you are committing specifically to an instance in a region for a specific period of time. They have a marketplace that you can sell it at a loss. They would never advertise it that way. Those are my words. In which you can go in and sell it at a loss if you made a mistake, right? But that's why on-demand exists. You spin it up, you try it, you're sure of it, you're good. I want it. I'll commit to it, and I get this big discount to do so. But it's not that drop is not... A, over the entire relationship, and B, once you are committed to an instance in a region, you own it or lease it for that period of time.
And on the Azure side, that doesn't exist. It's purely a monetary commit that you're drawing from, so a little bit different approach there.
Yeah, whereas on the AWS side, you're not telling them, here's my minimum spend.
On the DR question again, for situations where you're using public cloud to DR your private cloud, there was a time, at least I know, when you could migrate there, but you couldn't come back. Is that still the case?
I don't think it's a matter of couldn't. I think it's the practical realities of data size and difficulty, right?
Yeah, and on the Azure side, with what's called Azure Site Recovery, reverse replication for infrastructure VMs is enabled automatically. If it's a Hyper-V environment, VMware, since they did launch that, is now supported as well. So there's no checkbox. We've all probably been there with SRM, if you worked with SRM before, and how difficult that failback process was. You don't have to worry about that on the Azure side. It's automatically enabled if that site is still up and active.
AWS side, VMware import, export. But again, how big is the bandwidth? How much data? How long?
Is it real-time replicate with AWS?
No.
And there is SAN array level replication available now through vendors like EMC, NetApp, et cetera, for Azure.
I'm going to ask a question that hasn't been asked because I don't know the answer on the Azure side. What happens, so in VMware, I view this as a weakness on AWS. As in VMware, I'm used to having multiple hardware hosts with sessions automatically failing between those hosts with HA. How's that work in Azure?
So with Azure, an SLA instance means that you do have to have two instances up across two separate fault domains for that SLA of 99.95 to be maintained. And that's just for compute. Obviously, for storage and everything else, there's different SLAs and things available. But in order to meet that SLA, you do need two in a separate fault domain. So two SQL nodes, two AD nodes, et cetera, to make sure that you're meeting that SLA.
So on the AWS side, you can certainly spin up multiple instances in multiple regions and do all that stuff. My expectation and my hope as we go forward is that they will self-enable the ability for an instance that's on a piece of hardware that stops to automatically fail to a different piece of hardware like VMware does, and that is not happening today. If you ask me for my short list of complaints, that's one of them.
So if you have, it's now 12 o'clock, and I wanted to let everybody know, because lunch is served in those next sessions. Thank you very much for attending. Please, just a reminder to fill out your evaluations about speakers and sessions. Those of us on the conference committee really use those to start planning next year's conference to make sure our topics are on point. Thank you very much to our speakers. We really appreciate their time.
Thank you for coming.
That's a lot of work. Thanks, guys.